From KCUR, I'm Steve Kraske, and this is Up to Date. Making history come alive is tricky, but some historians manage to paint people like the Tsars of Russia or Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany not just as dusty textbook figures. This hour, we'll talk with historian Robert Massey about his vivid descriptions of the powerful people pulling the strings behind World War I. Later, we'll talk with a representative from the UN who has taken experiences from her home country of Norway to help lead a push for international gender equality. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. June 1914, the Bosnian town of Sarajevo. A 19-year-old Serbian terrorist fires two shots and assassinates Archduke Francis Ferdinand, heir to the Austria-Hungary throne. History has it that the murder was a spark that ignited World War I. 4 years later, the war ended. The killing that took place was beyond imagination. Nearly 5 million for the Allies and close to 4 million for Germany and the Central Powers. Robert Massey has written three histories of those war years, Dreadnought, Castles of Steel, and Nicholas and Alexandra. A Pulitzer winner, Robert Massey tells a story of living and breathing soldiers, statesmen, and the royals of those years who created the war and then fought to win it. He studied at Yale and Oxford, which he attended as a Rhodes Scholar. He was president of the Authors Guild, and he'll be in town next week to give a speech at UMKC. Bob Massey, such an honor. Welcome to Up to Date.
Thank you. Thank you, Steve.
Let's begin, if we can, Bob, at the end. What purpose did World War I serve? I mean, did it leave a legacy that is still with us today, or maybe not?
It left a legacy, but it was a terrible legacy. The world before the war was somewhat archaic, Victorian, stilted, class structures firmly in place. But the world that emerged from the First World War was in turmoil. Economies had been upset. As you said, millions of men had died. And we know that Germany, trying to recover, went to the Weimar Republic. They suffered an incredible inflation, and the result of that was Adolf Hitler. In Russia, the Tsar was replaced by the communist, first Lenin, and then Stalin.
Right.
And we all know what happened after that.
You know, you've written that the many causes that led to the outbreak of the war, and there were so many, some historians, and we just had one on our show this week, still think it's all but impossible, even today, 100 years later, to know exactly what happened to spark World War I. In your mind, Bob, is it still something of a burning question?
Yeah, well, the problem is there are multiple reasons, and they all piled on top of each other. First of all, there was the alliance structure, so that when somebody went to war with somebody else, the allies of the two powers joined in. And that brought most of continental Europe into the First World War. And then Britain was brought in because Britain was going to stand by France and Belgium. Then there was also personality involved, the personality of the Kaiser, William II, and the Russian Tsar, Nicholas II. All of those factors entered in. And there were the development of new weapons, which were totally destructive in their eyes, machine guns, artillery, and as we see coming back today, poison gas.
You know, you mentioned these alliances between nations. Bob, did we actually see countries wind up fighting other countries that they actually had no quarrel with at all?
Well, Germany and France had fought in the 19th century, and Germany defeated France and stripped away two French provinces. But France was weaker than Germany. France was not planning to go to war. The problem was that Germany had become this enormously powerful military industrial state created by Bismarck. And her two neighbors, to the east, Russia, and to the west, France, were not by themselves as powerful. So they allied with each other. And that meant that when the German war plan, Germany came in to support Austria, her ally, the German war plan meant going for France first, taking Paris, crushing the French army in France, and then turning on this gigantic but badly equipped Russian army and dealing with them second. That didn't quite work out, as we all know. The Germans never reached Paris. The French fought bravely. The British came in, and so it goes.
I mentioned in the onset here, at the outset, that Archduke Francis Ferdinand was assassinated. How quickly did war come after that shooting?
Very quickly, within a month. Within a month. Austria, Steve, had been looking for an excuse, a pretext, to attack and crush Serbia. Serbia was an independent Slav Orthodox state, and as such, a magnet for all the Slav provinces of the Austrian Empire, which was decaying rather quickly. And Austria wanted to crush Serbia. And knowing that an attack on Serbia would probably bring in Russia, the Slav Orthodox backer of Serbia, they turned to Germany to be sure Germany would stand by them. And so, as I said, the alliance system made a local quarrel in the Balkans spread across Europe.
Pulitzer Prize winner Robert Massey is our guest. He's the author of Dreadnought, Castles of Steel, and Nicholas and Alexander, and several other books. As I said, he's a Pulitzer winner. He'll be speaking at 7 o'clock on Monday evening in Pearson Auditorium on the UMKC campus. Tickets are available through the Central Ticket Office. There's no cost, but reservations are requested. Just go to umkc.edu, and you'll find a link to the Central Ticket Office there. You know, Bob, what's amazing about your books are, you know, all of this happened 100 years ago, but these characters are people you just almost couldn't invent. I mean, they're just amazing people. And one of them is Kaiser Wilhelm, who's been the emperor of Europe's most powerful military and industrial state. And yes, I'm talking about Germany, for 26 years before the war begins. Although he claims the title of Supreme War Lord, he had no military skills. What Wilhelm really liked about the army was the glamour of bright uniforms, parades, and medals, and playing the role of warlord. He changed uniforms 5 times a day and let it be known that when he commanded troops at army maneuvers, his side was always expected to win. This was a man who once said to an assembly of new recruits, "You have sworn loyalty to me, body and soul. It may come to pass that I shall command you to shoot your own relatives, brothers, even your parents, God forbid, but even then you must follow my command without a murmur." Why would he say such a thing?
Steve, you say that so well. I'm glad your book didn't come out at the same time mine did. He said that because he was half English. He was Queen Victoria's eldest grandchild. He'd been elevated by the early death of his father from cancer to the German throne at a very young age. He was immature. He was because he had a physical disability. He was nervous about his appearance. He strutted, he swaggered, and he used German military power to get his way in diplomatic contests. And he was not afraid of going to war. He threatened, and if war came, the Kaiser was willing.
You know, but even then, once he went to war, he struggled so much. He sort of took to his bed, I think, at one point, and had a hard time facing the reality of what he had gone about creating. Tell us about that, Bob.
Well, as I think I said, Germany plan to crush France quickly. When they didn't, and when Britain came in and opposed the British Navy, which was the supreme navy in those days, and imposed a blockade, William suddenly realized that instead of a quick war, a quick conquest of his enemies, France and Russia, it was going to be a long war. And as the tide began to shift and turn, first one way and then the other, William's essentially weak personality began to display itself. And it was on one of those occasions that the episode you were mentioning, when he just took to his bed and couldn't get out, happened. Eventually, the German warlords, Hindenburg and Ludendorff, had to pretty much take over not only the running of the army, but the running of Germany.
You know, it's just amazing that history turns on the personality of people like the man you're talking about here. I mean, that's just inconceivable to me that that could have been the case.
Well, Steve, you know, even today, if we look at leaders around the world or in the 20th century, during my lifetime, we've had monsters. We've had Adolf Hitler. We've had Joseph Stalin.
Yeah.
Certainly their personalities influenced not only the histories of their own countries, but the histories of Europe and the world. We've had Winston Churchill, who stood up to Hitler when Hitler was master of Europe in 1940. We've had FDR. We've had other presidents, some strong, some weak. We've had great warriors, et cetera, et cetera. I believe, and the kind of history I write focuses not only on the powers involved and the talking about in wartime, but on the personalities of the leaders. And I think they're important to all of us because they determine, I mean, I was a little boy during the Second World War, but I watched older boys go off to the military. Some didn't come home. And I was growing up in Nashville, Tennessee, a long way from war-torn Europe, but it affected me.
You know, Bob, you're right. You do talk about the personalities here, and one reason your books have remained as popular as they are because the figures you write about are so vivid. I want to turn and maybe have you read a little section from one of your great books, Castles of Steel, because this book starts straight, flat out, no foreword, no preface here at all, with a description of the man that we're talking about here, the Kaiser. Would you mind just reading the first few paragraphs of that section for us?
No, Steve, I'd be glad to. This is the opening line of the an opening paragraph of Castles of Steel. On an afternoon in early July 1914, a middle-aged man with restless, bright blue eyes and curly, iron-gray hair boarded his yacht in the German Baltic harbor of Kiel, and the following morning departed on his annual summer cruise to the fjords of Norway. Two unusual and striking features marked the vacationing traveler. One of these he was eager to display, the other he was even more anxious to conceal. The first was his famous bushy mustache, with its extended, upturned points, the creation of a skillful barber who worked on it every morning with a can of wax. The other, hidden from sight, but all the more noticeable for this, was his left arm, 3 inches shorter than the right. This misfortune was the result of an extraordinarily difficult breech delivery performed without anesthesia on his 18-year-old mother, Princess Victoria of England. He was unable to raise his left arm, and the fingers on his left hand were paralyzed. Every doctor had been consulted, every treatment attempted, nothing worked. Now the useless hand was gloved, and carried in his pocket, or placed at rest on the hilt of a sword or a dagger. At meals, a special one-piece knife and fork was always placed next to his plate. To compensate for the helplessness of his left arm, he had developed the right to an unusual degree. He always wore large jeweled rings on his right hand. Sometimes, grasping a welcoming hand so hard that the rings bit and the owner winced, the handshaker meanwhile said merrily, "Ha ha, the mailed fist, what?" That was William.
That's a great historian, Robert Massey, reading the opening lines from his book of Castles of Steel. You know, I'm not sure what amazed me more, the description of the mustache or the breech delivery that Victoria had to endure. But Bob, how did you know about the barber and the can of wax?
Well, I spent a lot of time in archives and libraries. And obviously, when I wrote this book, I was near the end of a long line of people who had written, and some of them very, very well, about the coming and the fighting of the First World War. And the material was there. Some of it was reported by people who were right around William, his staff, his relatives, his visitors, his English cousins. Being who he was and occupying the position that he did, he was a very notable object of curiosity, and almost everybody who met him wrote a description of him. So my problem was not finding interesting and colorful descriptions of William. It was deciding which ones to use.
You have said, I think, that the Kaiser was your favorite historical figure to have written about.
Well, yes and no. You know, after I finished these books, somebody asked me to write about Stalin. I didn't want to, not because he wasn't enormously, toweringly important, but because I couldn't imagine myself writing a balanced assessment of Stalin or of Hitler. The Kaiser seemed to me, as I grew to know him over the years I was working on these two books, to be as much a pathetic character as an ominous one. He did a great deal of damage, but he didn't. He was not a cruel man. Germany, in Imperial Germany, was not Nazi Germany. They didn't slaughter people in concentration camps. They didn't kill whole groups of people. Mm-hmm. They were aggressive. They were German. They were very proud. They were a very efficient country. They didn't see why they had been left out in the race for colonies, et cetera, et cetera. So William's personality was fascinating to me. I don't know that I would agree with my, if I said this, my former self, that he was the most interesting. Frankly, I've just written a couple of years ago, I published a book on Catherine the Great. Mm-hmm. I written about Peter the Great. They were fascinating, mostly admirable in their objectives, not always in their means. What human being, Steve, is wholly to be admired? Even those close to me, you have to stand back from a little bit sometimes.
Again, the great historian Robert Massey is our guest. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Our email address, UpToDate at kcur.org. You can also tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. Russ from Lawrence. Russ has a question about the Kaiser, and welcome to the show, Russ.
Hello. Not so much a question about the Kaiser as a question to you concerning the impossibility of personality making a difference. consider someone relatively ignorant but convinced of their own profound wisdom with an extraordinarily charismatic personality, although not always right in its direction, strange religious bent, or at least atypical, and making a huge difference in the role of the United States in the world and the way in which it views itself, even morally in regards to the Geneva Convention. George W. Bush and his personality made significant changes in the Eastern United States as one person. It can still happen. The person with the limelight makes the path.
Yeah. How about the comparisons, Bob, between the Kaiser and George W. Bush?
Can you
go there?
I don't know that I can carve out something or arrive at something that quickly. I've never thought of that comparison. Bush was elected, to add the simple part first, Bush was elected twice. The Kaiser was never elected. Monarchy was hereditary. That's one of the problems with monarchy. Bush, for whatever we think of him, and I'm a Democrat, but Bush tried to do the right thing. We, some of us, think he did not always do the right thing. But his personality certainly entered into it. His relationship with his father, mm-hmm. his determination to succeed, where, as he saw it, his father had failed to be reelected. His relationship with Dick Cheney. He thought he was exerting the power of the United States in a positive way. I believe that he really meant to bring, quote, democracy to the Middle East. The fact that neither he nor anybody or any of us really knew Middle Eastern politics or Middle Eastern religions and so forth, we're just beginning to understand it today, wasn't to be blamed against him. Maybe he was a little too, I'm talking about Bush, maybe he was a little too hasty in deciding to go to war against Iraq, which had an evil ruler, but which hadn't actually attacked us, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm sucking my thumb because I don't have a quick
You know, I want to turn to the sinking of the Lusitania, and let me just set this up for our listeners a little bit here. This is May 1915, 10 miles off the coast of Ireland, calm sea, bright sun. At the periscope that morning of the U-20, Commander Walter Schweiger sights a passenger liner, the Lusitania. He consults his copy of Jane's Fighting Ship, still in use today. He was using the 1914 edition. Jane lists the Lusitania as Royal Navy Reserved Merchant Cruiser. 6 days earlier, with a band playing dance music, the ship had departed New York with 1,200 passengers and a crew of 700. Schweiger opts to engage. His torpedo strikes the liner's starboard side and explodes. A second, more powerful explosion immediately follows. In just 18 minutes, the Lusitania sinks. 1,200 passengers and crew drown. 764 are saved, including 120 Americans. The question very quickly becomes, how will America respond, Bob? Former Presidents Roosevelt and Taft call for a war, but President Woodrow Wilson is determined to keep the U.S. out. And yet, hardly a year later, April 6, 1917, the U.S. declares war on Germany. What happened during that year in the run-up to the war, Bob, that gets the U.S. into World War I?
Good question, Steve. The difference was the Lusitania, sinking of the Lusitania horrified almost everybody, except in Germany, where they handed out medals and the crowds cheered. Americans were not involved in the war. They were selling arms, munitions to Great Britain. They said they'd sell them to anybody who came, because the Germans couldn't cross the Atlantic and bring back things against the power of the British Navy. And there were, in the hold of the Lusitania, a lot of cases of artillery shells, which the explosion of which did cause the second and final and fatal sinking. But because it was a British ship, because the Americans who were on board had chosen to take it, even knowing that submarines were circling the British Isles and torpedoing any ships bringing supplies, and in this case passengers, to Great Britain, the Americans had a less than full-blooded case against Germany. And Woodrow Wilson ran a year later, in 1916, for his second term, on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." Wilson wanted to keep the peace. But the Germans came out, the German high seas fleet, the dreadnought battleships, came out in 1916 in May and were not so much defeated by the British Grand Fleet under Admiral Jellicoe, but they suffered such severe losses, and the British suffered equally, and in some cases greater. But the Germans never came out again. And the German Navy said, we're going to turn to submarine warfare, mm-hmm. full speed, and we're going to make it unrestricted submarine warfare. We're not going to just torpedo British ships. We're going to torpedo any ship which enters this zone of submarine blockade. And they began torpedoing American ships. And finally, Wilson threatened. He broke relations. The Germans Germans were warned that the Americans might come in. The Kaiser was worried. He said to the chief of his naval staff, "What if the Americans do come in?" And the chief of the German naval staff said, "I assure your majesty that no American soldier will ever set foot on the continent of Europe." Hmm. Well, by November 1918, when the war ended, 2 million American soldiers were in Europe, and 2 million more were training in the United States. So much for German miscalculation.
You know, I don't want to make a too big a deal out of this, the second explosion on the Lusitania, but as you know, Bob, this notion that there were armaments aboard that ship, this is a key point in this whole run-up to America's involvement in the war. Other historians have concluded there weren't armaments in that boat. You're convinced there were. Where did you come up with this information that other historians have not come up with, where you actually list the tonnage of the armaments that were aboard that ship?
I don't know, Steve, right now. I would have to look.
Yeah.
I'd have to look first in Castles of Steel to the notes and see where I read about five or six books on the sinking of Lusitania. I don't know who these other historians are, and I don't know how they know. They may not know how I know. I said I took it from people who I thought were reputable. You know, Steve, historians don't always agree any more than politicians or married people or anybody else. But I would want to know who they were and what they said before I even tried to answer that. There we are. The some American politicians, William Jennings Bryan was Woodrow Wilson's Secretary of State. His argument for not getting involved or not getting that excited about the sinking of the torpedo of Lusitania was that the Americans on board knew that they were sailing into a war zone, knew that the Germans were torpedoing British ships, and having taken the responsibility for their lives on themselves, it wasn't up to the United States government to go too far in complaining or certainly in taking action.
Historian Robert Massey is our guest. He's written the books Dreadnought, Castles of Steel, Nicholas and Alexandra, and several others. He'll be speaking at 7 on Monday evening on the UMKC campus. More information on our website, kcur.org. Let's go to some more calls here at 816-235-2888. Let's go to Jeff from Richmond, Missouri. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Jeff.
It's my understanding, right or wrong, that the outcome of World War I drew the boundaries and created a great deal of the nations of the Middle East, Iraq, Iran, and all those other nations, Syria and what all, as a result of the treaty signed at the end of it, since those had all been part of the Ottoman Empire. And I've had this vague impression, but I'd like to have your guest address it. Let me know if I'm right or wrong and what else he knows about it.
How about the outcome of World War One and how it affected the Middle East, Bob?
Well, your caller is absolutely right. When the Ottoman Empire, which is gigantic and falling apart, entered the war on Germany's side, it was defeated when Germany was defeated, and all of the territories and provinces that your caller has listed were broken up and became independent countries. The Ottoman Empire, the basis of it, which is became what we now call Turkey, but all of the Middle Eastern countries going right around the north coast of the continent of Africa became independent. And their governments were installed by the victorious Allies, or at least supported by them. There were mandates. The British took Palestine as a mandate. The French took what's now Syria and Lebanon. The Italians took other territories, and so forth. But during the 20s and 30s, these were independent states, but under the influence of the great colonial powers. Britain still, in effect, ruled in Egypt, although the Egyptians had their own king, et cetera, et cetera. I remind you also, importantly, a result of the war was the breakup of the Habsburg, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, and a great many new nations were created in Central Europe and the Balkans. You can name them, I could, but there was that positive effect in giving these people freedom and they're allowing their cultures to flourish. They lasted for 20 years until Hitler came along.
Hmm. Speaking of Hitler, Bob, I'm going to go to Tom from Lawrence with a question about Hitler. Tom, we just have a couple minutes left. Go quickly, if you would.
Yes, I heard an historian give a hot psychobiography of Hitler, saying that in World War One he experienced mustard gas and attributed his monstrosity to that. And I'm wondering if we should be concerned about the use of chemical weapons and drone strikes possibly producing more monsters.
Hmm. Good question, Tom. Yeah.
We should be. I'd never heard that Hitler was seriously gassed. I know he was in the front line. He was a runner. He carried messages back and forth. He certainly saw a lot of action on the Western Front. I don't know. He was born in Austria. He was Austrian. There was a great deal of anti-Semitism in Austria. And when he was growing up, he developed his feeling that the Jewish people were, what shall I say, dangerous to European culture, and out of this grew all of the horrors of the Holocaust and Auschwitz and so forth. I don't know. I've never read, and I've read quite a bit, but certainly not everything. Anybody relating it to gassing. As far as gas goes nowadays and drone strikes, I'm against them both. We could be producing. We are still, we haven't used gas, of course. Nobody has since the First World War. I think I'm right. But it's not only morally damaging, but physically, gas can't be controlled. It goes where the wind goes. That's why the Allies were reluctant to use it themselves, although they finally did. Drone strikes are brand new. I'm sure the caller knows as much or more about them as I do. I'm sure they are useful in killing people, but I'm sure they are also building up hatred and animosity toward our country.
Bob, just a final quick point here. Your Castles of Steel book runs 788 pages. Its biography lists about 335 books that you got through to write that book. Did you really get through 335 books? That's a lot of books, Bob.
Yeah, it is. And I'm not saying I read every word in every book. I'm drawing from what I'm looking for and need from as many books as I can lay my hands on. I'm a very slow writer. I take a very long time. 8 or 9 years is my average.
Wow.
Peter the Great and Dreadnought took 11 years each.
Wow.
Writers, you think of them as sitting down in a chair and just dreaming away the day. They don't. They work hard.
Bob Massey speaks at 7 on Monday evening on the UMKC campus. More information about that event, a great opportunity to see one of our great writers, one of our great historians. More information about that at kcur.org. Bob, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for taking some time with us today, and I really, really enjoyed it.
It's been a pleasure for me, too, Steve. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Bob. And special thanks to my dad up in Stillwater, Minnesota, Robert Kraske, for help with today's script with Bob Massey.